the Zelensky's term came to an end, and it seems that he's continuing under the martial law. And at the same time, we're hearing that Poroshenko, the former president of Ukraine, he's not happy with the situation in Ukraine. Do we know what's going on right now in Ukraine, considering these political parties inside Ukraine?
I'm sure we know. I mean, it's difficult to get precise information because there is no free press in Ukraine. That's one of the, byproducts of a dictatorial regime under martial laws. They suppress the press. So it's not like we have a viable political opposition in there that's allowed to call out the government for its many failures. Ukraine says we are a wartime government under wartime conditions, and so we have to do that which we need to do to survive. So they've eliminated political opposition, they've eliminated the free press, they've eliminated elections. So let's stop talking about democracy and just understand what Ukraine is. And it's been for some time now. It's a military dictatorship. It's martial law where a civilian president rules, backed by not a constitution or the rule of law, but by muscle of the Ukrainian security services, a police state, the Ministry of Interior, etc. That's the reality of it. Now, you can make a case from the Ukrainian perspective that this is necessary. In fact, I would, to be honest, I would make the case that it's necessary. Democracy is ugly. Democracy is inefficient. Democracy creates fractures in society, especially in hotly contested times, that can be exploited by your opponents. That the greatest weakness the Ukraine could put forward to the Russians would be to have a viable political opposition that the Russians therefore could then support and create deeper fractures within Ukraine. That from a Ukrainian perspective, in war, you need unity of command, unity of leadership, unity of focus, and that if you can't support a democracy, can't support the elections the way they needed to be supported, as they would be supported in peacetime, then you take that off the map and just focus on winning the war. The problem is the man that's the dictator. He's not up to the task. He's not, he's, first of all, you'd want your dictator to be honest. You'd want your dictator to be somebody who could not be corrupted, either by power or by money. A man who cares about Ukraine, a man who cares about the future of Ukraine, a man who cares about Ukrainian democracy, who always keeps in the back of his mind that at some point in time this war will end. And when this war ends, I am going to step aside and I am going to be. Because once you become dictator, you can never be president. You can never be president. You can't go back to being president because muscle memory. You've learned too many bad habits. And those bad habits are okay during war where you need the singularity of a focus to win the war, to get defense production up, to make the cuts necessary, to mobilize when necessary. But you should be singularly focused on winning the war. Zelensky is singularly focused on sustaining corruption. It's all about corruption. Everything he does that talks about winning the war has a corruption aspect to it. It's about getting more resources, knowing that a certain significant percentage of those resources are going to be skimmed off by the top by the political and economic elite to enrich themselves. It's the way Ukraine works. Zelensky is the first to take off from the top. So, he is the worst possible person for this job. He is not a politician, he's a comedian. He was brought in as a figurehead. And so people use him to enrich themselves. The people below him aren't singularly focused on winning this war. They're singularly focused on making money. And when you build a team with that as their principal focus, they don't want to populate their subordinate ranks with guys who are going to do the job because honest people will look at the corruption and say, pow, shoot them, move up and say, no, we got to cure this thing. So the entire edifice is corrupt. There are no honest people in Ukraine. None. Every single one of them is on the grift. They're all liars. They sustain this lie. Some of them may be decent enough not to make fortunes themselves, but they understand that should they speak out, should they squeak, should they squawk, they will be crushed. And so they are complicit. It's like I've said in America that once an American police officer is on the job for more than 6 months, he's already corrupted. How can you say that? Well, because in that 6 months, I can virtually guarantee that he's seen another cop do something that violates the law, and he was silent about it. That makes him a corrupt cop, because a corrupt cop can tolerate no infraction of the law by a fellow police officer. None whatsoever. And the moment you do, you've bought into the corruption. So Ukraine may have people who aren't taking the money, but they are aware of those who are taking the money, and they are silent. They cover up for them. They are corrupt. The entire system is corrupt, and it cannot be redeemed. There is no hope for this. Again, if you had a hard man, an iron man, a dictator, you could even call him a brutal dictator, who truly loved his country and was truly doing this to help this country, his country, get through this conflict, with the understanding that he and his system will exit stage right when this is done, you could tolerate this kind of stuff. But not the corruption, but you could tolerate, you know, no free press, no that. But this fake democracy we have in place, Zelensky is no Winston Churchill, never has been, never will be. But the West continues to promote that. But at some point in time, you know, the emperor has no clothes, and Zelensky is as naked as can be. And the West can't keep pretending that he is outfitted in this remarkable outfit. He's naked for the world to see. He has to be removed. And who's going to replace him, though? Poroshenko? He's even more corrupt. He is the epitome of corruption. If you remember when Zelensky before he became president, he did this TV show, Servant of the People. And in it, he's supposed to be the great anti-corruption crusader that's going against the corrupt system. Who do you think the corrupt system was? Poroshenko. It was literally, the TV show was about, you know, this wonderful little school teacher turned, you know, populist president taking on Petro Poroshenko. It was a scheme designed to insinuate Zelensky as a believable presidential figure to fight the corruption of Petro Poroshenko, of the oligarchs, of the corrupt government officials. It was done on purpose to put that in the mindset of the Ukrainian people, so that when the time came to confront Poroshenko at the polls, Zelensky could say, I would like to be the guy I play on TV. I would like to be the anti-corruption crusader. I would like to be the man of peace. Now, he was just a comedian playing a part, but the people didn't know any better. Martin Sheen, there was a period of time where Martin Sheen could have run for the president of the United States. I would imagine if he was younger right now, and West Wing wasn't so long ago, that Martin Sheen could be the president of the United States today. Does he have any qualification to be president? None whatsoever, except one. He played an American president on a popular TV show, and many Americans, when they see them, say, that's the president of the United States. I believe that man could be the president of the United States. That's what they did to Zelensky. They put him up there. But the corruption that he was fighting in his TV show is the corruption of Petro Poroshenko. So Poroshenko is no alternative. There is no other alternative. You can go back and look for other people and previously, but they're all tainted by Ukrainian nationalism. The Ukrainians that came into power after the Orange Revolution were all ultra-nationalists. The first act that Yushchenko did was to elevate Stepan Bandera to the national hero of Ukraine. You want them in power? Ukraine has no viable option. The best political option for the Ukrainians actually are the Eastern Ukrainians, who fled when this conflict began. They are in Russia today. They have formed a government in exile. To the extent to which the Russian government actually, listens and absorbs what they have to say, I don't know. I can't say that. But these are the people. I've talked to several of them, and it's interesting. They say that when this war is over, they believe that Russia will be in control, political control, of the totality of Ukraine, and that there will be a purge of all of the Western Ukrainian-based nationalists and all of the corrupt oligarchs, etc. And the purge could take 3 to 5 years. But when it's done, the Russians will actually turn the system over to the Ukrainians and say, you elect your own officials, have a presidential election, elect somebody. And maybe at that time, the Ukrainian people will be able to elect somebody who isn't an ultra-nationalist or a corrupt oligarch or beholden to a corrupt oligarch or threatened by Ukrainian nationalists, to elect a real leader, a servant of the people, who can actually build genuine democratic institutions in Ukraine.
Yeah, you already know what has happened to Afghanistan. At the end of the day, the United States left it in the hand of Taliban. And right now in Ukraine, I think the future of Ukraine would be together with Russia, not with the United States, because the United States doesn't belong to that region. And Russia would be interested to have a prosperous Ukraine on his border, because it's so important for Russia as well. That's why it seems that Putin didn't decide to destroy everything on the western part of Ukraine.
It's interesting. I talked to, again, some of these Ukrainian politicians in exile, and I asked them, I said, you know, many in Russia consider Kharkov and Odessa to be Russian cities, Dnepropetrovsk to be a Russian city, Mykolaiv, Sumy, all of these to be Russian cities, and that, you know, they believe that this war can't end until Russia takes over the totality of the territory that historically has been known as Novaya Russia, New Russia. And these are Ukrainians. They are, some of them are ethnic Russians, some aren't. But almost to a person, they went, well, that's not necessarily the model that is going to happen. And I went, really? How do you explain this to the Russian people who think that it has to happen? Understand that Putin right now continues to only talk about consolidation of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk. He wants all of those territories to be, evicted of Ukrainian forces, and those are part of Russia. But there's no talk right now of Odessa, Kharkov, Sumy, Dnepropetrovsk becoming part of Russia. None whatsoever. There could be. But here's the thing. When this war is over, what does Russia want? Do they want a Ukraine that hasn't been totally defeated, continues to believe in NATO and EU as the direction they need to have, where ultranationalism continues to reside? That kind of Ukraine will just be a cancerous tumor attached to Russia that is going to cause problems down the road. You haven't cured the disease. You may have caused it to go into remission, but it hasn't been cured. I don't think there's anybody in Russia that will tolerate that outcome, not after the sacrifices Russia has made. So the tumor must be removed. Now, you can do this by cutting Ukraine apart in a way that destroys its viability as a modern nation state. But when you do that, understand that the cancer cells, these ultranationalists, they're going to go into diaspora. They're going to come in. They're going to go down to Elvin, New York, where there's already a Banderist base. They're going to go up to Canada, where Cynthia Freeland has all of her Nazis in place. They'll go to Australia. They'll go to Germany. They'll go into diaspora, where the intelligence services of the United States and Western Europe will provide them money to funnel resources back into Ukraine to keep the nationalism alive. And because you've created a Ukraine that's not a viable state, there will be unemployment, there will be poverty, there will be political unrest. And so the nationalist ideology, cancer cells can take root and begin to metastasize. And once again, you have the tumor. That's not an option either. The Ukraine that needs to exist has to be a viable nation state. It has to possess access to the sea, and it has to possess a viable industrial base that hasn't been destroyed. People say, why aren't the Russians taking everything out? Because at some point in time, there will be a Ukraine, a post-conflict Ukraine, and it has to be able to survive without a back-breaking investment of resources to rebuild it. One of the best ways to get Ukraine to revive is through self-revival. That means that Kharkov, Dnepropetrovsk, Odessa need to be working for Ukraine. Now, how can you do that if Ukraine is becoming a cancerous tumor again? You can't. You can't allow this industrial capacity to empower the cancerous tumor. So You eliminate the tumor. You have the industry now become viable and creates wealth and prosperity so that Ukraine is healthy. There is no diseased tissue that the cancer cells can attach to. All the CIA money is bouncing off because there's not a desire for it. This requires Ukraine to be whole, functional. But it also requires, in order for safety, that Ukraine to be connected to Russia, not the West. And the thing that these politicians told me is that the solution is a union such as exists between Belarus and Russia, a political, economic, military union. And that the solution is to have a Ukraine, a viable Ukraine, that is in political, economic, and social or military union with Russia and Belarus, an independent state, but an independent state whose future is only connected to Russia. There's no path to the EU. There's no path to NATO, only to Russia, because only by integrating the industrial base of Ukraine into this economic union can Russia allow that industrial base to exist outside of its sovereign control. Russia can't allow this industrial base to exist to sustain a cancerous tumor. It can only do it to revive a Ukraine that's part of a Russian-Belarus union that is promoting. And, you know, some people say, well, that's just a return to the Soviet Union. Yeah, but the Soviet Union wasn't a member of BRICS. Soviet Union wasn't a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. You see, the Ukraine that would be in union with Russia would have connectivity through Russia to the global economy. It wouldn't be this, this singularity that's attached to this larger dominant state. It would be part of a team process of engaging with the world, where its industry not only revitalized its own society, but strengthened Russia, strengthened Belarus, strengthened the world, a whole different approach. And I think that's the direction that the Russians are heading in right now. Again, this is purely an assessment on my part. I know you probably have a lot of people who watch this show and go, bullshit, Ritter doesn't know what he's talking about. Maybe I don't. I've been studying Russia for a long time. I've been talking to a lot of people. And that scenario seems to be, in the long term, the one that provides the best range of options for a positive outcome. For the people that promote taking Kharkov, taking Odessa, taking Dnipropetrovsk, those are short-term outcomes. But how do you prevent the cancer from coming back? Because the moment the cancer comes back, you're just going to be doing this all over again. If you promote the destruction of Ukraine, who's going to pay for it? And again, by destroying Ukraine, you create the disease of poverty, of social collapse, political disengagement, disenfranchisement, that allows cancer cells to come in and create the tumor all over again. You got to keep the Banderas out. You can eradicate the Banderas inside Ukraine, but they exist everywhere. They exist right down here by my house. And you cannot give the West the chance to reinfect Ukraine with the cancer of ultranationalism, of Banderism. And the only way you do that is to bring in all of your appropriate, I don't want to use the term vaccine because people say you're a pro-vaccine person, but you need to create the conditions where you have a healthy Ukraine that can fight off the cancer cells. And the healthiest Ukraine is a united Ukraine with a viable economic base that has a mission that doesn't promote the resurgence of nationalism, but promotes stronger ties with Russia, Belarus, and the global South.
Yeah. Considering the summit in Switzerland, they want to talk about Ukraine. At the same time, we've learned that Lula from Brazil, the head of South Africa, they're not going to be there because they don't believe that is any outcome coming out of this summit. And we still don't know if China would participate in this summit. But how do you think, when it comes to these type of summits on the part of the United States and European Union, is all PR for them, or why they're doing this?
It's a self-licking ice cream cone. It's just there to please themselves. There's no, how can you have a peace summit to talk about bringing an end to the conflict in Ukraine and not invite the Russians? So it's a joke. It's a 100% joke. If you allow Zelensky to come to the table and promote the Zelensky formula, which the Russians have said doesn't stand a snowball's chance in hell of ever becoming reality, even the West understands that, then this is literally an exercise in futility. If China comes, understand China will come after President Xi and Putin met, where Putin said, look, I support the Chinese initiative for peace. But the Chinese themselves are looking at saying, well, but we got to have Russia at the table. We can't be doing this. So, you know, even if the Chinese participate, it won't be because they're snubbing Russia. It'll be because Russia gave them not permission, but Russia said, okay, we're not opposed to this, but the Chinese will come with certain expectations that aren't going to be met by this conference. Therefore, this conference will never succeed. And the other thing about the Chinese is they're not big fans of futile gestures. If the Chinese sit down at the table, they are sort of hoping there will be an outcome. They're not there to play guesswork or to make people feel good. They're there to achieve a result. So I don't see the Chinese coming to this peace summit unless they have done the preparatory work where they have people saying that we've bought on to the Chinese peace deal. But the Americans will never let that happen. The Americans will never let a peace conference occur that actually achieves a genuine peace. And I just want to remind everybody that the American strategic objective towards Russia is the strategic defeat of Russia, and the Ukrainian conflict is designed to promote that defeat by weakening Russia, both militarily through a drawn-out conflict and by continuing to justify economic sanctions designed to strangle the Russian economy. The combined effort of a strangled economy and an endless conflict are supposed to demoralize the Russian population. So they rise up in a Maidan type event, the Moscow Maidan, to evict Vladimir Putin from power. That is the strategic objective of the United States. And you can never forget that when you talk about anything the United States does vis-a-vis Ukraine, Russia, or Europe. They're not there. The United States does not exist to come up with an equitable outcome, a peace outcome, a stabilizing outcome. The United States policy is to destabilize Russia, and it needs this conflict to do that. So the United States is not somebody you really want involved in this process because they're not interested in true peace.
How did you find Xi's visit to Europe? And after that, we had Putin's visit to China. But before Putin's visit, we had these new tariffs from United States on China and just increasing from 25% to 100% on China. It was a tremendous gift, I think, to Putin going to China right before that. And when you put these pictures together, what's your understanding? And we saw something so strange that we haven't seen before, just Xi embracing Putin. I talked with Ambassador Chas Freeman. He said that it means a lot when it comes to international relationships between these two countries.
Well, I mean, first of all, we need to never forget that Putin and Xi have known each other for a long time, and they actually have a very strong relationship based upon genuine friendship. Now, it's very dangerous for nations to allow the national interest to be driven by the personal friendship of their senior leaders, because the senior leaders are there to promote the interests of their respective nations. And you never want to have the potential of the interest of the nation being subordinated by issues of friendship. But we're talking not about children here. We're talking about two of the most experienced leaders in the world, leaders of major nations, the leaders who deal with issues on a magnitude that other leaders that we tend to, when we say, well, the Sunak, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, what has he done? But no, we're able to sit there and say, well, he's the Prime Minister of Great Britain. He's a great leader. No, he's not. Macron's been around for a little while, but he's the French leader. it's France. I don't even think they're going to pull off the Olympics. I'm very concerned about a rat-infested, bug-infested Paris. Putin has rebuilt Russia. He spent a quarter of a century taking Russia from the brink of the abyss into this powerhouse nation that it is today. Xi has overseen radical transformation of Chinese society. And again, in a way that the West hasn't picked up. I don't know how many people in the West know that not once, not twice, three times, Xi has implemented a 5-year plan designed to bring 300 million people out of poverty into the middle class. The population of the United States is just a little bit more than 300 million. Three times, Xi oversaw programs that brought the equivalent of the American population in totality out of poverty into the middle class. Three times. And China today is a nation transformed. We don't understand it. We don't understand anything about it. So we make bad assumptions and bad calculations. Russia understands it very well. Russia's been working with China. They've witnessed this. They've seen this. Russia and China are in harmony with one another right now. It was a little bit dysfunctional. If you took a look at their band that they were trying to put together in 2021, the guitarist was a little out of step with the drummer who was thinking he was playing jazz. He's supposed to play a rock beat, and the bassist was off doing something. We don't know. They were up there. They were trying, but it hurt the ears. After 2 years of war, everybody's singing from the same sheet of music. They're all practiced, rehearsed. Why? Because they've both come to recognize that the threat set that Russia faces in Ukraine is the same threat set that China faces in Taiwan. And that if China allows Russia to be bullied or defeated, then that same threat set will now come and bully and try to defeat China. That the best defense for China is what Russia is doing in Ukraine. To hold the wolves at bay in Europe so the wolves don't become empowered in the Pacific. The other thing is, when you speak of this transformation to a multilateral world, it's done economically, not militarily. And, China needs Russia. Everybody talks about China's, manufacturing potential. First of all, Russia is no slouch. Again, we tend to ignore Russia. I always advise people to go to Russia. That's why I go to Russia, to learn. The prime minister of Russia just held attended a digitalization summit or forum in Nizhny Novgorod, a city to the east of Moscow, where he talked about how Russia is going to be transitioning to the digital era. He, in the city of Sarov, they've built a laser institute. It's one of the top laser institutes in the world to incorporate digitization and laser technology into the manufacturing sphere. As part of the sanctions thing, Russia has empowered its own software developers, and they have some of the finest software developers in the world. Everybody talks about Russian hackers. You know that. Oh, the Russian hackers. Well, what is a software developer? A hacker who's doing things legally. Same mindset, same skill set, people who know how to do computer coding and things of that nature. The Russians have really good people, and they've built their own software industry. And so they've pushed Microsoft and Apple and all the other Western software makers out. And Russia has its own. And Russia now is working with China. Here's the beauty of it. You see, China isn't just the Chinese economy. China is the gateway to the global economy. So Russia, working with China, is getting its products out to the world, expanding its economic reach. It's sort of a big deal. The West just doesn't understand it. We don't understand anything about Russia. We don't understand anything about China. I don't understand anything about China, to be honest. I've read about it. I have a whole library of books that I'm reading about it. But, I think in order to understand China, you got to go to China. You got to see it for yourself, and you got to talk to Chinese and have them show you what's going on. Because we still have a lot of prejudice and bias built into whatever analytical models that we bring to bear. Even people like myself who are progressive in their thinking about China, there's a lot of built-in bias, a lot of filters, a lot of assumptions being made because of my ignorance about China. A lot of the books I read are 20 years old, 10 years old. And you can't be reading a 20-year-old and 10-year-old book except for historical relevance. If you want to know about China, you got to be reading the book that came out today because they are making advances. We tried to strangle China with chips, the computer chips. They're made in Taiwan, and we wanted to keep that technology. So I'm not a chip guy. I hope everybody understands that I'm just a Marine. Okay. I have a very specific skill set, and computer technology is not it. But I think I understand that there's things called chips. I got that part, computer chips, transistors, whatever. But they're made. One of the ways you make them is through a technique called lithography, I believe, and that has something to do with printing. And so you will print silicone chips that are embedded with certain things. And there's different ways of measuring the efficiency of a chip. And I can't remember if the higher number is good or the lower number good. I don't know. But there's a good number, there's a bad number. The Chinese were able to do a medium number, and we wanted to prevent them from doing the high number. So we unplugged them. We said they couldn't have access to this lithography technology that comes from, I believe, the Netherlands, which is available in Taiwan. Cut them off. Strangle their thing. We want everything to collapse. But you can't do that of a nation that of 1.4 billion people, because that nation has the ability to go, who are our best chip people? Well, we got a whole bunch of them. Many of them trained in America and in Europe, by the way. They go to those universities and they put them together and say, unfuck this problem. And all those little Chinese chip whiz kids sit there and they unfuck the problem quickly.